My Word.
A panel game devised by Tony Fine and Edward J. Mason. And here to introduce the team is Michael O'Donnell.
Thank you very much, and welcome to today's dramatic episode in the unrelenting philological struggle between Dillis Powell and Frank Muir, Antonia Fraser and Dennis Norden. Let's start with our usual quick plunge into the dictionary, see what we can find at the bottom. Frank, what's the meaning of Epicurean?
Well, nowadays it means having a high standard in food and things. You really want the very best. But it was actually Epicurus, wasn't it, who had a slightly different philosophical approach. But that's what it meant.
Could you hint at it? His approach. Not on a family programme.
I'd rather not discuss it. I'm not a gossip.
It's really a lot. Yeah, we'll give you the marks, too.
Oh, that's all right.
Give you the marks. I suppose it's a life devoted to the pursuit of pleasure. It's always the pursuit of pleasure, isn't it? The life of a glutton, a sybarite.
It's the almost the refinement of pleasure, isn't it? Not just the pursuit of blatant sensuality, but giving it good.
Refined, sensuous enjoyment, I think it says in the dictionary.
Not bad stuff.
A state with which you, of course, have not even a passing acquaintance, right? Antonia, the meaning of friable.
Oh, well, this is an easy word for anyone who pretends to be a gardener. It's when you're determined to plant something and you have it, and there's you, and then the earth, and then suddenly you think, I'd better look at the instructions, and the instructions say, make the earth friable. And if you're a fool, you send for a frying pan. But if you're sensible, you then start to sort of make curious gestures, which I fear will not go down the air. But after you've sort of friabled it.
A sort of crumbling.
Exactly. But it's not nearly as simple as crumbling it. I mean, although thanks for the tip, but it's not like that at all. And you go on doing it for some time, by which time all the earth that you've carefully assembled has vanished.
Can't have friable clay or friable gravel.
It's extraordinary you say that, because the definition is that which can easily be crumbled. But yet it's used in medicine quite often as a sort of, as things that can be easily torn. Patients who can be easily torn are a bit friable. I can remember a consultant teaching us when I was a student saying, one of the students said, yes, sir, this is a friable membrane. And he said, poachable maybe, friable no. Dillis, the meaning of a harbinger.
Harbinger? It's a word used in poetic language. It's a harbinger is a kind of herald, an announcer. The lark is the harbinger of dawn, isn't he?
Oh, yes.
I'm never up to here, but I imagine he is.
I'm reliably informed.
Yes, I'm informed.
Now, that's two full marks, neatly, concisely won. Dennis, what's the meaning of turn sick?
Well, I would imagine it's something that makes you feel a bit duff.
If you could particularise the sort of duffness that you feel,
would you feel what I think the Americans call nauseous?
That's vertigo. Really, was what was the word you were groping for? Was
vertigo.
It? Vertigo.
Vertigo.
Or dizziness.
Does it mean dizziness from height?
Well, no, it's giddiness and vertigo. Yeah. It's also a disease of sheep. It's the gid or the sturdy, and horses, the stagger.
Oh, yes.
Now, before we go on to the next round, let me give you the quotations that have been given to Frank and Dennis for the last round. Frank's is the heart of the matter. And Dennis's is The Flight of the Bumblebee, which is the piece of music associated, and you take your choice, either with Rimsky-Korsakov or Harry James, if you're the Riley, which I am. Meanwhile, on with one of these quaintly entitled rounds called A Mixed Bag. Frank, from your corner of the bag comes this question. What French word adapted into English do we owe to the uplifting genius of an American lady, Miss Mary Phelps Jacob?
It's not the bra.
It is the bra.
Well, I now hang on a bit. I did some work on this for a chapter in a book, and it was the modern bra was developed from the old boned one by an American lady in 1914.
That's right,
Caress Crosby.
She devised a homemade harness in which two handkerchiefs,
that's right,
united by ribbon,
baby ribbon,
played the sporting. I think we ought to give an extra mark there, don't we? Don't you?
Well, no, there's none at all.
I learn an awful lot on this programme. Antonia, Henry Wadsworth Longfellow won half the New World's glory. Can you detect anything curious about that statement?
Oh, it's an anagram, is it?
Clever girl, yes. Full marks. Well done. The acclaim in the second half is an anagram of his name. Henry Wadsworth Longfellow won half the New World's glory. Dillis, what connection is there between Sir John Suckling, the 17th century poet and playwright, best remembered perhaps for the lyric beginning, "Why so pale and wan, fond lover," and the parlour game of cribbage? What's his connection with cribbage?
I think he invented it.
Well done.
He didn't.
He did. Dennis, George Bernard Shaw, hostile to the vagaries of English spelling, once pointed out that the word fish could phonetically be spelt goatee, G-H-O-T-I. Can you explain how...
Yeah, I'm afraid I can. It's just one of those things, either you know or you, you know. And if you get these publications which deal with what I think are called playful linguistics, this is a good old GH. And I'm trying to think. GH, as in, for example, enough. Or tough.
That gives us the F.
That gives you the F. The O is I, as in women. O as in women. And the T-I, as in any word that ends in shun,
station,
for example, station,
yes,
or rotation or something.
So
it's fish. There's one you can do with potatoes as well, in which there's O-U-G-H, starts with U-G-H as in hiccup. And ends in E-A-U as in bow.
Well, I'm delighted you knew it. Well done. I'm sure the full... I could never have given you a clue. That's why I'm delighted you knew it. Now for a round of things that have something in common. Frank, what do the following have in common? Mein Kampf, The Pilgrim's Progress, and a 17th century history of the world.
If the 17th century history of the world, as I'm sure it is, was by Raleigh, it was written in the Tower. Pilgrim's Progress, Bedford Jail. Mein Kampf, in a prison in Germany.
Full mark. Full mark. Antonia, what do the following have in common? A sickener, a death cap, and a false blusher.
Sickener, death cap. Now, they're not mushrooms, are they?
Well...
Toads, sort of toads.
Yes, well done. The erudition is flying around the studio today. Dillis, what have the following got in common? Under the Greenwood Tree by Thomas Hardy, Sad Cypress by Agatha Christie, and Remembrance of Things Past by Marcel Proust.
They weren't all written by the same person. were they all written in the same... Not written in the same language, no.
Under the greenwood tree. No.
The same poem.
They're all Shakespearean critics.
Yes, yes. They're all from...
Under the greenwood tree.
You and your close friend, Mr. Muir, I think got that between you. We'll give you full marks. Well done. Dennis. The provoked wife, the relapse or virtue in danger, and Blenheim Palace all have something in common. What or who?
Well, provoked wife and relapse were written by John Vanbrugh. And Blenheim... I know John Vanbrugh designed the Haymarket Theatre, as was the Haymarket. So presumably did he design Blenheim Palace?
Yes, he did. Got his hand in with the Haymarket Theatre and then expanded it a bit to Blenheim Palace. Well done. Now we come to the round that always taxes the chairman's skill, and we reveal to our listeners that we have a hidden member of the team, a scorer, Leonie Hadley, who is going to count while I listen, because we're going to do one of these rounds of monosyllables, where I'm going to ask each of you to describe something in at least 25 words without using words of more than one syllable.
An ant.
Yours, Frank, your subject is 007.
Oh. What a name for a spy. But his name is Jim Bond. I say Jim in case you might think that James is more than one.
You've got it. James. No, no, stop. Stop.
But he's tough.
You've done 25 words.
Oh, I've got a lot more to say here.
Antonia, let's move on to a much simpler subject, and one of which I gather you are a world authority. Your subject is the exact whereabouts of Oliver Cromwell's warts.
Old Noll's warts must be on his head. But where is his head, we ask? It was on top of his limbs in the past. But the head, warts and all, to coin a phrase, was chopped off the head when King Charles II came back to his own. And so the head was put in the ground. Near York, they say. Who am I to say? But where the head is, there are the warts, you may be sure.
Dillis, your monosyllables have to be on how to fry an egg.
Make it friable.
I do not cook. But I will try to tell you. You take the shell off the egg. If you leave it on, it will not be good. You take a pan, a round pan, with a thing to hold it by. And you put some fat and turn on the gas. The egg will spit at you. But you need not mind.
Oh. And Dennis, this is something we've all been waiting for. Your first action upon becoming Prime Minister.
If I ruled the world, to coin one more phrase, I would pass a law that shops in the high street which have a clock outside which have a clock for all to see would be fined a lot of cash each time that clock was wrong. Right? Right.
Let us move on to the last round and Frank and Dennis's quotations. Now, Frank, your quotation is "The Heart of the Matter." Tell us the origin of that.
Well, it's a book by Graham Greene. Well, I'm going to get a bonus mark now.
Get one mark for that.
I'm in a position tonight, Doctor, to relieve mankind from the hideous embarrassment when you don't know what to say, either because you don't understand the question or because you really have nothing important to say but you feel you have to talk, or that you talk and you want to obscure. All these things are terribly difficult. But I've discovered an even better way, which is not obvious, that you sort of ride with the punch and you will never feel any kind of embarrassment. And I developed this process because of French. I'm not very good at French, you see, because when I was at school, my first year at school, I missed French. You never catch up if you miss it in the first year, do you? I missed French because I had my appendix out. I also missed the beginnings of algebra because I had some wisdom teeth out. And then I also missed geography because I had a small bone out of my foot. At the end of the first year, I was not only light in learning, I was about half a stone light in weight. But anyway, I could never catch up with French. And my wife is half French, and she speaks it perfectly. So I just left it to her, you see. There's no problem. All through our married life, when we're in France, I leave it to her to talk. But it doesn't do, and sometimes I'm on my own. And I've made little tentative efforts, and the embarrassment of it. Because I know about 180 words in French, and about half of them are very similar to the other half. I was invited to stay overnight with a friend who had a rather beautiful villa at Cap Ferrat with a swimming pool. And he was extremely rich and extremely nice. And I went for a swim, and afterwards I got out of the water and said, "Ah, oui, c'est très, 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 très beau, le pissoir." The word is piscine, of course. It actually got worse, because he sort of smiled rather bleakly and with a Gallic shrug of his shoulders, and everybody else tittered. But the following day when I got up, he'd emptied the pool. And there were eight servants scrubbing it with rush besoms. So this way of avoiding these sort of confrontations. And when people talk to me in Corsica, they all talk in extremely rapid, rather Parisian French. Our neighbours, Parisian. And Parisian French is like a French LP played at 45 revs per minute. And it all flies at you. And it's all, "Monsieur Mitterrand, il est bête, il est bête." And it keeps appealing to me for, "Oh, hey, Franck, c'est ça, n'est-ce pas, c'est ça?" And I developed a technique of not actually saying anything, but making noises. I say, "Oui, oui." "Oui." "De temps en temps, oui, oui, oui." And this can apply to England as well. What you do is you do a creative mutter. That's the answer. If somebody said to you, "Did you see that terribly important thing on television last night, that feature programme, when you've been watching Coronation Street?" So you don't say no, or go, what you say is, "Ah,
interesting, eh? Well, how do they? I wonder. It was so. And they can't bear not to tell you what it was all about. Sometimes at a party, you know, Kafka. Do you read Kafka? You don't just say no, or you say Kafka. The one thing about Kafka, you know, if there is one thing, it's... Well, surely, I mean, he's Kafka, isn't he? I mean, he's Kafka. And then wait, and then we'll tell you all about Kafka. And is this creative... Well, I'm writing a book about how to cope with it, and I've got a title for it, and it's a sort of Graham Greenish title, really. I'm going to call it The Art of the Mutter.
Thank you for that useful social tip. Dennis, your quotation is The Flight of the Bumblebee.
The other Saturday afternoon on telly, there was a 1941 film called Hold Back the Dawn. They all had titles like that in those days, and it reminded me what an important part of the adolescent mating rituals of that time our local cinemas were, especially the one that we used to call Sammy's Bug Hole. It was a legendary venue just off the Kingsland Road, Dalston, where my close friend, Les Winkler, once claimed to have broken three commandments just during the second feature. Now, personally, I was never as fortunate as Les, mainly because the only girl that I could ever get to accompany me to the Bug Hole during that period was one called Nanette, or as I've since come to think of her, No Way Nanette. Now, the reason that I never had any difficulty getting her to go to pictures with me was because her family and mine were very close. In fact, their scullery used to leak into ours. But that didn't help me as far as any Bug Hole success with Nanette was concerned, partly, I now think, because by temperament she did happen to be the sort of girl Greenland could well have named a glacier after, but also because that whole back row of the cinema game had to be played according to a sort of tacitly agreed set of rules. And the most important of these was that the game always began with the male player essaying a furtive little movement that one might tactfully call sleight of hand. Now, this took your arm across the back of her seat and round her shoulder. But from there onward and downward, every succeeding move brought you into what war communiques of the time used to call heavily defended area. Your final jumping off point being the knee, whence, according to the conventional wisdom of those days, anything could happen. But never did, except in the case of Les Winkler. So shall I tell you, the furthest that I ever reached in that game, I never even got the first move right. Now, of course, that was partly explained by the fact that I was so inordinately tall for my age, all my jackets had become at least two sizes too small, with the result that the material across my shoulders was stretched so tight, my movements were always restricted by what would now be called arms control. But in addition to that handicap to backseat manoeuvring, I also seemed to encounter hazards that were undreamt of by other male Wallies of my generation. There was the time when just when my creeping hand had arrived midway across Nanette's back, I got my hangnail snagged in her Angora sweater. I didn't remember those. They're coming back, those. Then there was the afternoon when she'd kicked off one of her shoes, which is something girls in cinemas did ever such a lot in those days. And while she was leaning back in quite uncharacteristic indifference to the progress I was making, she suddenly realised that a man who just pushed past us on his way out must have kicked the shoe halfway up the gangway, so that when it was thwarted while I went after it. But what finally inclined me towards celibacy was the evening when, just about the moment when my slithering fingers were just about to surmount an unexplained protuberance, one of her false eyelashes suddenly dropped into her vanilla tub. Well, as I say, those were just some of the memories summoned back by that one old film. But I wonder whether those recollections of the bug hole are just a symptom of something else. Perhaps my whole preoccupation with the movies of that period is simply just an expression of sympathy with the predicament of all those who have groped unsuccessfully in darkened cinemas, a misfortune that was summed up so well by Rimsky-Korsakov's well-known composition, The Plight of the Fumble Knee.
Thank you, Dennis, for evoking those memories of back rows long since gone. It only remains for me to tell you that today's winners are Dillis and Frank. But Antonia and Dennis, I'm sure, will strike back in our next programme. Until then, goodbye.
In My Word, Michael O'Donnell was in the chair. The questions were compiled by Peter Moore, and the programme was produced for the BBC by Tony Tryon and Pete Atkin. You've been listening to My Word from the BBC, heard each week at this time. This is the WFMT Fine Arts Network.